Hi, I'm Tess Vigeland, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of January 6th, 2012. You know, dealing with hospitals is rarely, if ever, a fun experience, and not just because you're sick and in pain, but help is on the way.
Besides medical, there was also stress, bills, the rent, so we had to budget and a spreadsheet to show where your money going, this is what's coming in, this is what's going out.
And what would you say if I told you that when it comes to putting a proper value on things, your worst enemy is the person in the mirror?
You think a football player has made more tackles if their jersey number is 97 than if it's 27.
We'll look at how your mind plays tricks on you when it comes to numbers. And if your mind is making it hard to save or create an emergency fund, how about we just call it something else?
I like to think of the emergency fund as what I will call for the moment the screw you fund.
A rose by any other name. Those stories and more on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. In case you haven't heard it enough, Happy New Year. All kinds of new laws took effect as of this week, especially at the state level. But we're going to start today with a look at year three of the healthcare reform law. As you may know, most of the really big changes don't come around until 2014. But our healthcare reporter Gregory Warner is here to outline a couple of things to keep an eye on right here in 2012. Hey, Gregory.
Hi there, Tess.
Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
So how does a medical reporter spend his New Year's Eve?
My New Year's Eve was spent getting free babysitting from my in-laws.
Nice.
I trucked up. You know, it's incredible how far you'll drive for free babysitting. I realized that being a new dad.
Well, we wanted to talk to you as the new year starts because, of course, as we just said, there seem to be all these kind of benchmarks that come along in the Healthcare Reform Act that was passed a couple of years ago. And so, you know, we're kind of wondering what's in store for us in 2012.
Yeah, I'll give you two of them. First,
okay.
And I'm going to start this one with a little mystery. I know you like a good mystery, right,
Tess? I do.
This represents how hospitals are going to be changing in 2012.
Okay, that just sounds like somebody knocking on a door.
And you would be right.
Oh, thank
that
you.
That is someone knocking on a door. But here's the thing. That door is not in the hospital. That door is in a low-income housing development in West Philadelphia.
Happy New Year!
Happy New Year.
How are you?
All right.
The person behind that door, the person answering that door, his name is Reggie Wiles. He's an Army vet, formerly homeless. He's now on Medicare. And he's got this thing called chronic obstructive pulmonary disease, COPD. Mm. It means he gets these spasms. He ends up not being able to breathe. He has to call the ambulance over and over again, like clockwork, once a month.
What causes this? Is he a smoker?
He is, exactly. But the thing is, once he leaves the hospital, you know, doctors don't know what to do. I mean, all they can tell him is, hey, don't smoke. And then just wait for him to return. And, of course, that costs the system an enormous amount of money. Here's what Reggie has to say.
But sometimes when I do go back in the hospital, I'll be feeling so embarrassed because I'll be going back and forth so much.
So he says he's embarrassed. Wow.
Right. He's embarrassed. Meanwhile, though, taxpayers are paying tens of thousands of dollars in Medicare dollars every time he goes back to the hospital. And all the hospitals can do at this point is tell him, hey, don't smoke, and
right.
Then, you know, wait for him to return.
So what does this have to do with how hospitals are changing because of the healthcare law?
Okay, so it goes back to that knock on the door.
Mm-hmm.
So the healthcare law is going to start fining hospitals when they allow Medicare patients to readmit within 30 days. So now the hospital has this financial interest to make sure Reggie doesn't come back to the hospital too soon. So now Penn Hospital, in this case, is actually sending a community health worker to Reggie's house. Her name is Sharon McCollum, and she's going to deal with his medical issues, but she's also going to deal with his financial issues.
Besides medical, they was also stressed besides the bills, mm-hmm. the rent. They didn't have no phone. So we had to budget and a spreadsheet that I had created for them to show where your money going, this is what's coming in, this is what's going out. So his stress level has came down, and it's keeping him from going back and forth to the hospital.
Wow, interesting story.
So Reggie went from 6 hospital visits in 6 months to just 2. That saved the system money.
And I guess that's good for his finances, too.
Yeah, sure. He's got fewer medical bills. He's connected with all these services, some of which pay for his medications. But it's also good for taxpayers because that means fewer Medicare dollars spent.
Okay. Well, so you might expect a knock on the door, folks. So you mentioned there are 2 ways the healthcare law may change things this year. Oh, what's the second?
Okay, this one. Now, tell me if you've had this experience. I call it doing the shuffle.
I do it all the time. But that's not what we're talking about, is it?
No, I'm the healthcare reporter, Tess. Okay. But this shuffle I meant was when you go to the doctor and then she sends you for lab work, so you make that appointment, and then you're back to the doctor's office, that's the third appointment, then you're at the specialist.
This is sounding very familiar. Yes, this is quite the pain.
Now, this is not only a pain, it also costs the system a huge amount of money.
Hmm.
And there's a money side to this too, which is that hospitals and doctors, the way they're paid is per procedure or per test.
Right. This has been a common criticism of the system, the way it operates.
Exactly. And this is what you hear about our fragmented system. Yeah. There's this uncoordinated care that costs patients pain and also costs a lot of money. So the healthcare reform law, it takes that on and it basically sets up these organizations. They're called accountable care organizations, ACOs. We're going to hear that word a lot in 2012.
Okay.
These systems basically work kind of like the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic. Doctors are on salary. The hospitals and doctors share the bill. And they don't pay per procedure. They pay per disease. So out of that sum, the doctors and hospitals kind of figure out what to do. It rewards efficiency and basically means you and I are spending less time running around making appointments. And the idea is to create kind of this one-stop shopping experience in the hospital.
All right. And this all goes into effect this year.
Yeah. And the first 32 of these ACOs started this week, actually. They're called the Pioneers. We might see hundreds more later this year.
Okay. Thank you. Marketplace's Gregory Warner joining us to talk about healthcare.
Thanks, Tess.
So how'd you do with that whole holiday budgeting thing? Stick to it? Did you even make one? Well, all that generosity over the holidays tends to come into stark relief as bills start to arrive in January. We wandered the streets of Shreveport, Phoenix, and Chicago to find out how folks are coping with the financial holiday hangover.
I work in a warehouse, and it'd be hard because where I worked, I had all that overtime and that extra money. Now there's no more overtime. And now it's back to not buying this and not buying that. Basically, go the cheaper route.
Several years ago, we started saying, okay, you know, there's no sense really in putting a lot on credit cards for Christmas. Just kind of, we kind of budget through the year for that. I told my kids, Jesus got three gifts. That's what we're getting. I mean, you know, and they kind of looked at me like, what?
I think it's as always, people spend what they don't have and spend the next year trying to recoup it so they can do it all over again.
I will cut back a little bit just to get back to my normal levels. I don't know, at my work we have a bonus in April, so money will be raining then.
Oh, so April showers include money from the sky, huh? Lucky man. Well, somewhere in there you heard promises of better behavior in this new year, and a lot of you did financial resolutions, right? If one of them was to start an emergency fund, good for you, but be careful what happens to it.
Peter, that was our emergency money. And your daughter just so happens to need a new pair of glasses.
Lois, no one really needs glasses.
You wear glasses.
That's only to fool the man from the draft board.
I can't believe you squandered that money. I swear, sometimes I feel like I'm married to a child.
She is. Anyway, if you're finding it hard to even conceive of having an emergency fund, here's a tip. Rename it. Rename it something unprintable, something that would get me in trouble with the FCC. Meg Favreau of Wisebread.com joins us again to help out with that one. Welcome back.
Thanks for having me.
So we're going to talk today about the famous, infamous emergency fund. Only we're going to have a slight twist on this. The emergency fund is something that we basically preach about week in and week out on the program. And frankly, I think people are probably tired of hearing it.
Yeah, no, I think so too.
Aren't we all? Save, save, save. Don't ever spend any money, right?
Yeah. I like thinking about the emergency fund slightly differently because Okay. Here's the thing. The emergency fund obviously isn't fun.
No, it's boring.
It's so boring.
It's like, well, what if nothing ever happens? Then my money's just sitting there.
Yeah. Plus, you don't want to think about something bad.
Well, that's for
happening.
Sure.
You know, I think that's one of the hardest things to wrap your head around and really commit to is to get yourself to save money for something awful happening.
Right. Which is why a lot of us don't do it.
Exactly.
So what would help us do it?
I like to think of the emergency fund as what I will call for the moment the screw you fund.
Oh, why don't we take a page from CeeLo? We'll call it the forget you fund.
I think that's perfect. The idea with the forget you fund is that it's money that is maybe the exact same amount of money you'd put aside for an emergency fund.
Okay.
For example, that could maybe be used for an emergency, but it's also primarily money that you have so you can give the middle finger to a situation you're in that you don't like. Can they say give the middle finger?
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
Sweet. So the idea is you have this money set aside where if you are in a bad situation with a job,
mm-hmm.
if you're in a bad situation with a relationship, if you're in a bad living situation, you can just say, forget you, and you have the money to go off and live your life how you want to.
Have you ever had one of these yourself?
Here's the thing. I didn't for many years.
Mm.
And I was in situations where I really, really could have used one. For example, I had a job that made me cry regularly.
That's not good.
No, it's not good. And I didn't have savings at that point.
So you're stuck.
I was stuck. Where if I had a forget you fund, I could have just gone out of there immediately instead of doing what I did, which was quitting with no other work lined up.
No, not the best thing to do.
Yeah.
Then let's get down to brass tacks. And how big should your forget you fund be?
Realistically, $1,000.
Hmm.
If you have at least $1,000, that can cover a lot of things. That can cover needing your car repaired.
Okay.
Or rent for a month. Or living expenses for a couple of weeks until you get that next job.
Right. So $1,000, that is totally doable.
Definitely. And yeah, because I mean, emergency funds are so intimidating. And I feel like when you're first starting out in the workforce, it's hard to save a lot of money. So yeah, $1,000, totally doable. Once you get that, look towards $2,000.
Okay. So you can start small, build from there. But the key here is to really change your mindset. It can't just be a boring emergency fund. In fact, you know what? Maybe we won't even use that term on the show here anymore. I wonder if we can get to that point, but we're going to start calling it the Forget You Fund.
I like that. I highly support it.
All right. Well, thanks for coming in, and we'll look forward to folks starting up their Forget You Funds. I love this.
Great. Thanks for having me back, Tess. And, you know, I was going to close this by saying forget you, but that's really
no,
rude.
Let's not do that.
No.
All right. Think you always have your own best interest in mind when you're spending money? Think again.
The advertisement said, buy some for your freezer. Okay. And the other condition said, buy 18 for your freezer. And people bought considerably more when they were encouraged to buy 18 for their freezer than when they were encouraged to buy some.
Numbers and Trickery, later on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. It is time once again for your questions. Helping us out this week is our good friend Chris Farrell, the economics editor for Marketplace. Hello.
Well, hello, Tess. And I just have to say, Happy New Year.
Happy New Year to you as well. Did you have a wild and crazy night on the first?
Oh, I think I'm now on to 10 years in a row where I haven't managed to stay up long enough to see the ball drop. So you know I'm a wild and crazy guy.
I love that. Well, I'm guessing that apparently the president made one of his New Year's resolutions to make a recess appointment before heading
yes.
up the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. This was a big piece of news in our wheelhouse this week. Perhaps some folks are wondering what difference it's going to make now that they have a chief.
I think it's going to make a big difference in two senses. One, it puts the Consumer Protection Bureau, you know what, top of the list, near the top of the list in terms of the contest for the White House.
Oh, so maybe then the CFPB becomes a topic of conversation in the presidential race?
Yes, it does.
Yeah.
It's probably not going to be a good conversation, but I'm eternally optimistic. And in my internal optimism, I hope that the purpose becomes clear, the reason why it exists becomes clear. It's really just to make comparison shopping easy. I mean, that's the baseline of what it's supposed to do.
And that certainly seems to be the direction that they've headed in thus far, even without someone at the head of the agency, where they're making mortgage papers easier to understand. They're making credit card agreements easier to understand so you can actually, as you said, comparison shop.
And that's not easy to do, by the way. I was at a conference with economists, and, you know, this is what economists love. And they're talking about how difficult it is to sort of make the information clear and,
right.
And so that you can, you know, sit down at your kitchen table and say, well, I think this is, you know, fits my needs better. Nonetheless, I think that's the right area to go into.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's head to the phones. And Sam is with us from Concord, New Hampshire. Hi, Sam.
Hey there. How you doing?
Good, good. How was your New Year?
It was mild, sort of funny weather out here.
Funny being warmer than usual, right?
Yeah, well, I mean, we finally got a cold snap now, but I was in short sleeves on Christmas Eve.
On Christmas Eve, so it was what, 40?
Yeah, I mean, I might have edged up into the 50s.
Yeah, but you see, Tess would be in a down vest. At 40,
well,
right, Tess?
No, my friend, I am in a down vest at 65, okay?
Well, you know, they grow them hardy up here.
Well, what do you do there in Concord?
Well, you know, believe it or not, I'm actually a reporter for our local public radio station.
Oh, fantastic.
Great.
Love
Wonderful.
To hear that. What do you cover?
I'm general assignment for the moment.
So will you be covering the primaries coming up here, I assume?
Oh, goodness. Absolutely.
Yeah.
Everyone will be covering the primaries.
Right. Everyone and their dog will be covering the primary. Well, so what brings you to our neck of the public radio world here on Marketplace Money?
Well, so I'm newly minted as a reporter.
Mm-hmm.
I just got this job, and it's allowing me to actually save for the first time in my life. You know, as a sort of developing public radio nerd, I started listening to Marketplace Money just because I thought I should be listening to more radio. And, you know, my eyes were open to the world of all the things I should be doing.
We tend to do that to people. They're like, oh, shoot, I should have been doing that and that and that.
Right. So right before the end of the year, I opened a Roth IRA.
Yay! Pat on the back for you.
Thanks. And I maxed it out. I put $5,000 in it, only to discover that it's not over. You know, I have to allocate these monies into investments.
Ah, yes.
So I have no idea what to do. You know, I've never been interested in finances. So I asked my fiance's father, and he said, oh, put it all into stocks. You're young. And that sort of strikes me as just absolutely terrifying. I thought I would poke around a little bit.
All right. Well, how young are you?
I'm 25.
25. Okay. So you are very young. Sam, how much do you know about the stock market?
Well, let's see. Is there a way to have negative knowledge of this? I think I have a good sense of sort of generally how economics work.
So, Chris, I think this is a great question. You know, a lot of young people hear us talk about the need to start retirement early, start the planning early. But there is more to it than just setting aside money. Now, I don't know if we're going to tell them to throw it all into stocks. But I think probably the best thing to say is that we want you to keep it simple. So, Chris, where does he start?
Well, and I just want to reiterate what Tess just said. The really important thing, and the thing that I am just so happy about, is that you opened up the account. And, you know, I don't want to say that your father-in-law is wrong, but I would approach it a different way. I think it's very important to think about what to do with this money differently. But the main thing is, while you're figuring out what to do, it's perfectly fine if it's in an FDIC-insured account or something like that.
So in other words, there's no rush to get this money
somewhere. There's no rush because the most important thing is that you start it. So the way that I like to think about it is to start from a different place. I like stocks. But, you know, I don't know where the stock market's going to be over the next year, over the next 5 years. Rather than starting from you should put everything in stocks because stocks over the long run are going to pay off, where I want to start is a different place, and that's your career. How secure is your job? And if your job is really at risk, if there's going to be lots of up and downs in your income, you're going to want to be more conservative with your portfolio. If your job's going to be pretty secure and you got a pretty good path and you can kind of see where things are going to be going, you could take a little more risk, i.e., add a little more stocks.
Chris, how about a couple of books that Sam could read just to dabble in, you know, at the very least, understanding how stocks work, how price movement works, how it's performed over time, that sort of thing.
Yep. You know, I have one book to recommend for anyone that's in Sam's circumstances. Just the questions that you're raising is by Burton Malkiel, and it's called A Random Walk Guide to Investing. And it's very short, but it deals with all the basics. But it's a really clear, well-written guide to investing. And it basically gives you the stock of knowledge that you can then say to your father-in-law, you know what? That's not a bad idea, but here's why I'm not going to go all in stocks.
All right. Sounds good.
Thanks so much for the call. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Next on the phone, Vanessa is with us from University Heights, Ohio. Hi, Vanessa.
Hi, Tess. How are you?
Very well. Happy New Year.
Well, Happy New Year to you, too.
Did you have a good one?
Well, we had a little bit of excitement. We went out to dinner with friends, came home about 1 in the morning, and this random guy ran up my driveway to me, claiming he had been robbed and asking if we could give him a ride somewhere.
Oh, good Lord.
Oh, my God. Oh,
what did you do?
So my husband says, I'm not giving you a ride. And he pulls out his phone. He says, I'll call the police for you. And at that, the guy took off.
Whoa.
Hello,
I bet you're awake
2012.
At that point.
Oh, Happy New Year.
Wow. That
so I got all my bad karma out of the way.
Well, that's a good way to look at it. Well, what do you do there in University Heights?
I make drugs. Okay, the legal kind.
Okay. Thank you for clarifying.
Yes, that was a nice pause.
Perhaps
there.
That was why someone was in your driveway?
It could be. No, I work for a pharmaceutical manufacturer here in Northeast Ohio.
Uh-huh. Have you been doing that for a while?
I have. I've been in the industry longer than I care to admit.
I know Ohio has been really hard hit by the recession and the housing downturn. Is that the case there in your neighborhood?
You know, it is. We are actually, I live in University Heights. My neighbor city, Cleveland Heights, that we share a school district with, was featured on 60 Minutes.
I saw that story where they're tearing houses down, literally just bringing in bulldozers instead of letting them sit there so that property values don't decrease even more than they already have.
Yeah, it's disappointing when you have these beautiful old brick homes that just won't sell.
Right. It's a very interesting solution.
You know, I always had this problem, you know, with the brick ones. I mean, I understand like in places in Florida with modern construction, places empty for 6 months, they're really not livable. But, you know, boy, some of these homes, it just seemed to me, could have waited.
Yeah, it's tough though, you know.
Yeah.
Well, how can we help you out today with perhaps your personal finances, not your city's finances?
I can't work on the city.
Right.
Here it is, the end of 2011. There it was, the end of 2011.
Right.
And I'm thinking, okay, so I have some extra money in savings. I want to go ahead and invest it while I can toward my retirement.
Good.
So I know that there are restrictions when it comes to IRAs and Roth IRAs. There's salary restrictions.
Right.
So we can't contribute to IRA.
Okay.
So I said, well, you know, why don't I just make a lump sum end of year contribution to my 401k? And I'm like, okay, well, why don't I call my Fidelity person and just make sure, you know, that this is all kosher and everything. And I was talking to her and she told me, oh, you know, there's a restriction on how much money you can contribute to a 401k.
That's right.
And I was floored. I'm like, wait a minute. How did this get past me?
Right.
And I go back and I look and I'm like, uh-oh. I'm already over.
Okay. Now, Chris, I'm going to get on my soapbox here, which I've gotten on before about this issue. I think it is absurd to limit how much people can contribute to a retirement plan.
That's right. Yeah. But here's the thing that really gets me. So since you're on your soapbox, I'm getting on mine.
Okay.
On 2012, you can put $17,000 into your 401k, 403b. That's if your employer happens to offer one of these plans.
Yep.
Now let's say I decide, well, I'm going to stay at home and raise the kids. I can put $5,000 a year into my retirement savings plan. Now, can you explain to me why, if I walk out of the house and go to work, I can put aside $17,000, and if I stay at home, you can only put aside $5,000? Yep. And it's absolutely insane, and it's Byzantine. And why not just come up with one rule? I don't know. What is it? 20% of your income? $30,000, whatever comes first. Doesn't matter who you are, what you are, what you do, or whatever sort of mechanism. But this notion of this system that we have with all these different restrictions, it's insane.
It is absolutely insane. So basically, Vanessa, what we're telling you is we don't understand. We agree. We think it's absolutely absurd. But the fact is, you know, the rule is what it is. And, you know, you mentioned that that your employer actually allowed you to go over the federal limit. And that's because they don't keep track of that stuff. So what will probably happen is that you will get a refund from Fidelity.
Right. So what am I supposed to do? You know, I don't want to be a drain on society when I retire. I want to be able to save my own money.
Right. Well, the key here is that the limit is on your pre-tax income. But there's nothing that says you can't set aside in a savings account or in a brokerage account, any amount of money that you choose to.
And Vanessa, you know, so much of our discussion about savings has become synonymous with retirement savings.
Yes.
You know, that's really only one transition in our lives. It's a big one. But there are other transitions people want to be able to fund over a lifetime. Take the opportunity, as Tessa's saying, to save in taxable accounts to fund a different transition. You might want to change careers. You might want to downshift careers. You might want to go back to school. And the thing is, if you have those savings available to you, you can make those transitions in your 30s, in your 40s, in your 50s, and not wait till your 60s.
Okay.
So does that help you out?
That does. That helps a lot.
Excellent. Excellent. Good question, Vanessa. Thanks for writing in. Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Marketplace Money is supported by Money Magazine, offering advice on stocks, funds, markets, the economy, college savings, and retirement, now on tablets. Available on iPad, Nook Color, Kindle Fire, and on select Android devices. Money.com/allaccess. Sustainability coverage is supported in part by the Candida Fund, furthering values that contribute to a healthy planet.
This is Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. All right, and finally, we have Christina from Atlanta. Hi, Christina.
Hi.
What do you do there in Atlanta?
I work in construction.
And how is that business going, given the housing downturn?
You know, it's definitely suffering in the recent years, but I'm employed, so I'm happy.
Yay.
That's always a good thing.
It is,
yes,
definitely
it is.
A good thing. Well, how can we help you out today?
Well, I just had a question. I've been saving a lot since I got out of college. Actually, when I was in college, I was saving too. But anyway.
Wow. I'm not going to let you go there. Please tell us how you started saving in college.
Well, I had a little bit of money from my mom.
Okay.
But I also had some merit scholarship. And so I got a part-time job and worked through college to keep the bills paid. And then invested the money that I was given instead.
Now, is that something that your parents instilled in you growing up, that was important?
I don't think I had a really good foundation in money saving, but I had a college professor that became a mentor, and he actually just suggested one day in the middle of class, he said, I know that most of you, this will not apply, but if any of you have money that you absolutely don't need to be spending, you should start thinking right now about retirement. And I thought, this guy's crazy, but I didn't talk to him and figured I should go ahead and save.
I love him.
Wow.
Yeah, that was probably the best thing I got out of
Hey, you know what? You might be able to retire when you want to because of that.
I certainly hope so. So my question was...
Yeah, so it sounds like you've got everything taken care of.
No. I was looking for new ways. You know, I went through a transition in jobs recently and making more money now than I was before. And I thought I really need to be more clear on what my strategies are for investing. I asked my brother, and I was put in touch with someone that he's worked with as a financial advisor. They looked at my finances and said, well, you're doing great saving. I had some funds that were not invested that I thought I should invest these. And they said, no, you need the emergency fund. And I know you guys have spoken to that quite often, keeping that there. And when your employer makes available the 401k, that I should be contributing to that. In the meantime, he actually suggested using life insurance. And initially I thought, well, that's interesting. I don't know much about it. And I started Googling, and then I got really scared because everybody says, don't do that.
Yeah. Okay. So you want to know if you should be investing in life insurance as tax-free retirement savings, right?
Yes. And if what are my other options? And in another kind of wrinkle to it is my husband. And I don't know if I should bring that in there, but he's not really much of a saver, and I'm wondering if I'm better suited in putting something away for him than going about something else.
Okay. Well, let's deal with those separately, Chris. Let's start, first of all, with the question about life insurance.
Okay, I'm in the camp that believes life insurance is to protect your loved ones against your death. That's what it's for. And so what I like is term life insurance. which is a pure death benefit if you need life insurance.
Chris, why would a financial advisor have told her that life insurance would be a good place to park her cash?
Well, you know, one very big reason is it tends to be a high commission product.
There you go.
That can be one reason. Now, this financial advisor, though, was telling her also some good things about when she can participate. Christina, when you can participate in the 401k, you know, go ahead and do that. I just think unless you have a really good reason for owning what we call cash value life insurance, there's no reason to own it.
Okay. Then let's get to the question that, Christina, you just kind of brushed through there, but you said that your husband is not perhaps as good a saver as you are. Is that right?
Right.
Does he have a retirement account?
No.
Okay. So, Chris, perhaps another place for this cash would be, you know, she could open an IRA for him.
You know, this is one of those cases where it's not unusual for savers and non-savers to be attracted to each other. And so, yes, he's going to want to have his own retirement savings account. If he doesn't have savings, you're going to build up savings. And so here's my main recommendation, Christina, on this and how to deal with it, which is you want to have a weekly money meeting. But you have it same time, same place. And what the weekly money meeting will allow is, you know, to have conversations about, well, how do we build up our savings? Let's get you a retirement savings plan. You don't have one at work, so let's do something over here. You do have one at work. Let's get you in there. And then things don't fester, and it doesn't become where all of a sudden you have a big conversation about money, which is one of the most boring, stressful conversations you could ever have. And so
you should talk to him.
Yeah, you just do over a period of time.
Yeah, just make it like a money date night or something like that.
Yeah, it's a better way. You know, that's like the much better phrase.
Yeah.
All right. Well, yeah, I can definitely suggest that to him.
Okay, great. Well, thanks so much for the call, Christina.
All right. Well, thank you.
Our number is 877-275-6669. That's 877-ASK-MONEY, or you can send us an email at the Getting Personal link on our website. It's marketplace.org. Chris, thanks so much.
Thanks a lot, Tess.
And do remember to always check with your own financial professional before you make any big money decisions. Investments make money, and some are good for the environment, and some do both.
It's a really nice way for individual people who don't have a lot of investment income to contribute to something that they believe in and that you can feel good about.
Pooling money for solar energy, coming up on Marketplace Money from APM, American Public Media. So here's a word familiar to you, dear listener, risk. Risk tolerance, to be specific. As in, to figure out how much money you should have in stocks, you got to figure out what your risk tolerance is. How much you could lose on paper before you lose your lunch. But how do you know what that number is? Aaron Klein wants to help you figure it out. He is the CEO of a new company called Riskalyze. Aaron, welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
So tell us how Riskalyze works.
Sure. Well, you know, investing is broken. I think most people would agree with that. There's just way too much emotion and conflict in our investing decisions. Mm-hmm. And while technology has transformed so much of our world, we really haven't changed how we make investing decisions at all. The missing puzzle piece is still our personal and unique tolerance for risk, because it's subjective and it lives in our head and our gut.
Right.
And so the technology we've invented transforms your subjective risk tolerance into a quantitative mathematical function that can lead you to the investment decisions that fit you.
Well, you know, it's risk is something that we talk about all the time on the program. And, you know, the mantra is, you know, figure out what your risk tolerance is. And
right.
As you say, it's such a personal thing that I find it hard to imagine how technology could figure that out for you.
Sure. Well, you know, rather than ask you 50 questions about your income, your age, your kids, we ask you to make 12 simple investing decisions using an amount of money that's meaningful to you. You're teaching our algorithms when you're going to trade certainty for risk.
But how do you even know how to answer that very first question, which is how much money are you willing to lose? I mean, if you asked me that, I would have no idea how much I'm willing to lose, because I'm willing to lose different amounts at different times, I would
think. Sure. No, great question. And I would say two things to that. First of all, you're absolutely right. It's critical that we have to really consider the impact of our choices and how losing or gaining those amounts of money will affect our lives. So it's a pretty important 12 questions. You're not going to want to take those lightly. You're going to think about it and say, if I lost this amount of money or if I gained this amount of money, what does that mean that I can or can't do, you know, about retirement, about sending my kid to college, about buying a house, whatever those things are in your future? And so if you don't answer those accurately, you're correct that that's not going to work. But I would also say that it does change over time. And so events in the market are going to change not just our portfolio, but it's also going to change our tolerance for risk. And so your risk fingerprint changes on a regular basis. Our recommendation to our users is that they update their risk fingerprint at least every 2 months and then see if the changes are significant enough that they should consider rebalancing their portfolio.
Why do you think it's so hard for us to understand our own risk tolerance?
I think that's a great question. I think, you know, part of it is that it's a very emotional topic, right? There's very few topics that can match the emotion level that comes with money. I think to some extent, we know it better than we realize. Because if we start having to sit down and make a decision, you know, if I came to you and I said, Tess, so here's an investment, and here are the probabilities of success and the probabilities of failure. And so you've got, you know, a 52% chance of making this much money and a 48% chance of losing this much money. You'd be able to just look at that decision and say, no, this is not for me. There's too big of a downside here. And I might look at the same decision and say, you know, this is the right decision for me. That works for me. And so we know our tolerance first, but we don't know how to quantify it, and we don't know how to apply it.
Well, and I think sometimes, you know, we look at those percentages and we're like, wait a minute, you want me to do math?
Exactly. Exactly. Help me translate this to an outcome in my life. Money is not the end, is it? You know, money is a means to an end. Our families, our lives, our careers, these are all the things that we do in life that have meaning more than just money. And so you definitely have to connect that to what the consequences are of a change in your financial net worth.
Aaron Klein is the CEO of Riskalyze.com, and we will have a link to that on our website at marketplace.org. Aaron, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you, Tess.
One of my favorite things about this show is we get to talk about our brains, why we do the smart and not so smart things we all do with our money, because so much of it is about emotion and hardwiring. So today we're going to explore something called price anchoring. It's something that happens every single day in your decision-making process, including the decisions that you're making about how you're going to dole out your precious dollars. Nick Epley teaches behavioral science at the University of Chicago Booth School of Business and joins me now. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
Why don't you kind of describe for us in your own words this idea of anchoring and how we do it in our everyday lives?
It's actually simple. Anytime a number pops into your mind, it influences your judgment. So you think a football player has made more tackles in a year if their jersey number is 97.
Really?
Than if it's 27, yeah. Or a car mechanic. If you come into the mechanic's shop and you say, do you think this will cost more or less than $1,000? They'll estimate that it'll cost less money than if you ask, do you think this will cost more or less than $5,000?
Huh.
So it shows up in so many places. It's all over the map. If I ask you, is Mount Everest taller or shorter than 50,000 feet? What do you think, Tess? How tall is Mount Everest?
Oh, geez, I should really know this. Less than?
Less than 50,000.
Yeah.
Okay, how tall is Mount Everest?
30? 28?
It's pretty close. So
yeah.
It's 29,035 feet. If I'd ask you, though, is Mount Everest taller or shorter than 5,000 feet, chances are you'd have given a much lower estimate.
Well, no, because I lived in Oregon, so I know that Mount Hood is 11,000 feet, and I know Mount Everest is taller than Mount Hood.
That offset the 50,000-foot anchor just a little bit.
Yes.
You were using
yes,
a slightly
indeed.
Different anchor, yeah.
In fact, I anchor everything to what I know about Mount Hood.
Is that right? All things?
Yes. Well, everything in life.
How much is in your bank account? It must be less than 11,000. Must be more.
Certainly
who
less.
Knows?
Than- I am an anchor woman.
You are. That's right. There you go.
All right. So how do companies and Madison Avenue use this to sell us on products and things?
Well, I don't know the exact details because I'm not in Madison Avenue.
Right.
But I do know how it can affect consumers. There's a really neat study by Brian Wansink, a researcher at Cornell University. He went into a grocery store and put up different advertisements for Snickers bars. And in one condition, the advertisement said, buy some for your freezer. Right? In the other condition, it said, buy 18 for your freezer. And people bought considerably more when they were encouraged to buy 18 for their freezer than when they were encouraged to buy some.
So what is happening in our brains there?
Well, a couple things are happening. One is that the decisions that we make are made online. Right? So when you go into a grocery store, if you got a list, you kind of know what you're going to buy, but then a lot of decisions you make on the fly. How many Snickers bars do you really need? Well, I don't know. And the way we make things up on the fly are by attending carefully to numbers that are out there, and sometimes those numbers can be arbitrary, like buying 18 Snickers bars for your freezer.
So is this something that we can use as consumers to affect our own behavior?
Well, it's a kind of phenomena that you need to be cognizant of. You need to be paying careful attention to the anchors that are relevant, like the amount of money that you have to spend is relevant for whether something is affordable or not. So the cost of a Toyota Camry last year is relevant for the cost of a Toyota Camry this year, if mm-hmm. you're trying to figure out what that is. Or the close of the stock market yesterday is very relevant for the close of the stock market today. So lots of anchors out there in the world are relevant. What we need to be on guard for are the irrelevant ones. What you pay on your credit card balance isn't a function of what the credit card company tells you is the minimum amount you could pay. It's a function of how much can you afford to pay on this. Or even in a salary negotiation, it's been shown that the opening salary offer matters a lot for the eventual price that you get at the end of the negotiation. It's been shown to influence judges' decisions of the sentence that should be awarded to somebody. So the prosecutor's suggested sentence influences the judge's beliefs about the length of a sentence.
You know, I just have this picture going through my head from that movie, A Beautiful Mind, where all those numbers and facts and figures were floating in and out on the screen. And I guess yeah. that's what we are all going through, perhaps not quite as smart as that. But, you know, on a daily basis, we are surrounded by numbers and they are affecting us.
They are. I think the bigger problem is, unlike in A Beautiful Mind, where there are lots and lots and lots of different numbers and broad ranges that you might consider for any given problem, the problem that we have as human beings, normal human beings, is that we tend to consider one number. One anchor value. And that's the problem we get into, not considering too many. It's just that we consider one, the one that's easiest to bring to mind sometimes.
Nick Epley is a professor of behavioral science at the University of Chicago's Booth School of Business. Thanks for coming in. It's been fascinating.
Thank you very much for having me.
When you live in a place with a lot of shade, it can be a challenge to generate electricity from solar power. That was the issue for the residents of University Park, Maryland. So in an effort to solve that problem, they decided to pool their money, and they used the money to install solar panels on top of a local church, forming a small power plant in the process. From WYPR in Baltimore, Stephanie Hughes has our story.
Carolee Vixler has been playing electric organ at the Church of the Brethren in University Park, Maryland, since she was 15 years old.
French horn. And then the oboe.
For the past year, that organ, along with everything else in the church, has been powered by solar panels.
Yeah, for years I had been looking at this roof saying, wow, we could do something more of that space.
Don Monroe is a member of the congregation. He's also part of the University Park Community Solar LLC. the group responsible for the panels.
I think in this church, and certainly in a lot of other churches these days, there's a real sort of consciousness of what we call care for creation. And this very much fits into that idea.
The project came about because it's one of the only suitable spaces in town. The group's president and founder, Dave Brosh, spent over a year trying to find a roof in University Park that would work.
Our neighborhood is filled with trees, and we have a lot of houses that are not oriented in the right way. So we decided we need to look for a large roof and then combine our money together and bring it to one spot.
The group bought and installed the panels in July of 2010. Individual members could buy in starting with $2,000. Now they sell the energy to the church at a rate slightly lower than the local utility. Then the company sells excess power back to the grid at wholesale prices.
The whole installation cost $130,000. So I guess you would say that bought me 1/13 of this power plant.
Lisa now is another member of the LLC. Under the group's business plan, she can expect to recoup her $10,000 investment in 7 years and then receive an 8% return in about 20.
It's a really nice way for individual people who don't have a lot of investment income to contribute to something that they believe in and that you can feel good about without having to lose money doing it.
Community solar has interested not just people who live in tree-lined towns, but also those who live in places with shared roofs, like apartment buildings and condos. Dave Brosh says he's been contacted by people all over the country.
Connecticut, North Carolina, California, state of Washington. We've been giving information to anybody who would like it.
However, University Park's model won't work everywhere. Anya Schulman is the founder of the Community Power Network. She says local regulations determine how much money you can make by generating solar power.
It really matters what incentives are in place. So I usually tell people, you've got to figure out whether you want to work within the existing incentives or if you want to change the incentives.
Schulman says the models for community energy run the gamut. Some are barn-raising projects, where people lower expenses by learning how to install solar panels themselves. University Park is more of a crowdsourcing model, where lots of people come together to cover costs. But she also said the more people involved, the more complicated the project gets.
University Park is pretty unusual, and the reason is that it takes some real stick-to-itness to get one of these projects done, perseverance.
University Park is now trying to replicate its own model. Dave Brosh says the group is currently in talks to put panels on top of a school, a synagogue, and another church. But it's not just a matter of finding a suitable roof. It's working out all the details.
When you're doing something at a community level, it always requires a little more organizing. Since we're a very democratic group, democracies tend to be a little messy. But it's more than just the panels. It's people working together.
So while you may still need an LLC to make a profit, it's starting to look like you may be able to turn to your village to raise a solar array. In University Park, Maryland, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace Money.
And a special note today, we are doing Ozzie Smith backflips here in the studio as we welcome new listeners in St. Louis, Missouri. We know you don't pronounce it Missouri like others do in the Show Me State. So, St. Louis wins the World Series, and now you gain Marketplace money. Does life get any sweeter? Well, it does with a Ted Drew's frozen custard, doesn't it? Anyway, we're tossing back a Dr. Pepper and saluting our financial colleagues at Edward Jones, Scott Trade, and, of course, the 8th District headquarters of the Federal Reserve. Thanks to everyone at St. Louis Public Radio. We look forward to a great 2012.
No need to worry. I ain't in no hurry. Missouri loves company. Minneapolis through St. Paul. The pain's the same and that ain't all.
And finally, to this week's Marketplace Money Piggy Award, our little blue plastic friend is heading to, wait for it, St. Louis, of course, and the home of Gerard Chase, who may need more than one pig to store his cash. Chase is a newly minted Missouri State Lottery winner to the tune of $2.4 million. Now, what makes him pig-worthy? Well, because he found out back at the end of November that he had a winning ticket. He put it in a safe deposit box and then spent 6 weeks coming up with a financial plan before cashing it in on Wednesday. Our piggy hearts you, Mr. Chase, and congratulations.
Oink, oink. Oink, oink.
And that is Marketplace Money for this week. You can friend us and me on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at Radio Tess. Next time, falling home values and foreclosure are far from the only consequences of the housing bust.
The combination of neglected housing, abandoned housing, and then this crime issue all put together, this is a recipe for disaster.
Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins and Stephen Hoffman, to whom we bid a very fond and sad farewell this week. Gonna miss you, buddy. Special thanks also to John Hawes. Our theme was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. I'm Tess Vigeland. We'll see you next week.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org, or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM, American Public Media.